श्रीला गुरुदेव की जय, श्रीमन महाप्रभु की जय, श्री हरि नाम संकीर्तन की जय, गौर भक्तवृंद की जय, गौर प्रेमानंद हरि हरि बोल। सो प्रणाम टू ऑल ऑफ यू, गुड मॉर्निंग फ्रॉम बुएनोस आयर्स अर्जेंटीना। And today we are continuing with our weekly series of Histagosti or Q&A, questions and answers, where everyone is invited to present whatever topics, inquiries, you may have doubts that we may elaborate on upon. So as usual, we are trying to promote this type of, foster this type of exchanges in our Gaudiya community, so in the spirit of love and trust, we may feel inspired to open our hearts in the context of, again, Harihara, Harikatha, sorry, in the context of Satsanga, in the context of Shravan, Kirtan, all the things are to be in place for us if we want to make progress on the path, on the Bhakti Marg, on the path of devotional service. So, that said, we have one question that has been sent to me some days ago by Ashwin Jagtiani. So, I'll begin with that one. And in case any of you may have any other inquiries you may like to share, please send it through the private messenger, or at least tell me that you have a question, so eventually you may have be given the chance to present it. So his question goes like this: how should devotees aspiring to practice Uttam Bhakti react when they come across someone suffering materially? Should one pass on the merits, quote unquote, of one's sadhana, as has been suggested on social media recently in the context of the Ukraine invasion, to alleviate the suffering of others? Does doing this compromise the very definition of Uttam Bhakti? Does it make a difference if the person suffering is a devotee, karmi, yogi, jnani, materialist, pious, non-pious, or anything in between? So this is the question. Of course, there are many questions in the context of one main inquiry, which of course is quite related to contemporary issues in the world at present, so, and how we are to deal with that internally, externally, in every sense, how we are to approach the situation, approach the ones involved on the situation on one degree or another, and so on. Of course, as you may know, some days ago, maybe a week ago, I shared some brief words connected to the idea of be the change you want to see in the world, like making a play of words with famous quote by Mahatma Gandhi, be the change you want to see in the world, and extending that with the war, and how we are to address the principle of war, starting at home, and dealing with our own inner war, our inner battles and conflict, before we want to speak, share opinions, and do something about some other wars that even may be used as an excuse for us not to deal with our own war that has to be solved, because whatever conflict we find on a global level, on world level, it all starts on the individual level. So as much as we are not doing all that we can to solve our own personal war against ourselves, against our best interests, as much as we still are acting against our best interests, on that same level, we are not able to do something else regarding other wars, if you will, because we are actually promoting war by not dealing with our own war properly. So, of course, that won't be my official reply to this question, but I'm just sharing a brief recap of those words shared some days ago, since somehow they are connected with this. And that said, mostly this question is then speaking about how we are to do something about this in the context of practicing Uttam Bhakti in such a way that that help or compassion or whatever we express in the context of this present situation is fostering, is upgrading our Uttam Bhakti and not otherwise. Because that can happen, for sure. So that's an important point to consider. No? In the name of something, some need of the moment, in the name of something good that is deemed as pious or necessary or whatever, we are to know how to do that in such a way that our ideal is basically expanded within ourselves. So, in brief, before trying to unpack some other thoughts, I will say that there is a way to approach all the things in such a way that it's not compromising our Uttam Bhakti. But it all depends on the conception we have when approaching a particular situation, even beyond this one. So it's all about conception. So because conception is the very root that will take us to action, and action will take us to a certain particular prayojan or fruit. So sambandha videya prayojan. So sambandha means conceptual orientation. So how we see ourselves, how we see what's around ourselves, outside of ourselves, how we properly conceive, conception. How do we conceive what's going on in the world, who we are, what is expected from us in the context of Uttam Bhakti. So when that conceptual orientation is in place, avideya, or the natural action that follows, will come and foster the specific prayojan that we want to attain. And of course for us, it all that is in terms of bhakti, of Uttam Bhakti. Having a proper conception of Uttam Bhakti, having a proper practical engagement of Uttam Bhakti, and of course attaining the ultimate fruits of Uttam Bhakti. All of which again is in terms of bhakti. Bhakti, bhakti, sadhan bhakti, bhava bhakti, Uttam Bhakti. So to begin with, of course, I just will briefly mention the very definition of Uttam Bhakti, which I hope you already know, because you should, since you are practicing that. So if someone asks you, and not necessarily someone, you should ask yourself, what the hell I'm doing here? What I'm supposed to be practicing as a follower of the Gaudiya Sampradaya, as a disciple of my Gurudev, as a member of this particular lineage of Krishna Bhakti, which is the very definition of bhakti that we are trying to embrace. So that's present in Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu, that's been shared by Srila Rupa Goswami Pad in the very first section, 11th verse, Anyavilasita Sunyam Gyan Karmadi Anabritam Anukulyen Krishna Anushilanam Bhakti Rotama. Very important, well known verse, no time here in this particular session to fully unpack all implications of such a refined definition of bhakti. And it's a definition that it's non-reductionist, if you will. It reaches a point that it cannot be nothing but what he's intending to be. It's so specific that if you properly understand the meaning of each word, it cannot mean anything but Uttam Bhakti. It, by itself, it's cancelling all other possible, more diluted conceptions of devotion, you know, through the mentioning of both Swarup Lakshan and Tatastha Lakshan, the main qualities and the secondary qualities of bhakti. Of course, the main qualities are Krishna Anusilanam and Anukulena. That Uttam Bhakti is directed to Krishna. Krishna is the Vishaya Alambana of Uttam Bhakti, or the object to which this type of bhakti is directed. It has him as the object of bhakti. Stai Bhav is in connection to Krishna as the Vishaya Lambana. To Krishna, Anushilanam. This is it's a practical engagement that is engaging all the different functions In the context of not only doing those things which are pleasurable to Krishna, but anukulena. Anukulena means not only, again, doing those things that are favorable, anukulya sankalpa, but engaging in them with the desire of giving pleasure to Krishna. Not just casually doing something that Krishna loves, or knowing, oh, he loves him, so I will do that, but actually your intention is somewhere else. So it's, again, it's full commitment to this project, if you will, of having Krishna as the perfect object of love. As we know, he's a really very perfect object of love. He can fully receive, he can properly reciprocate, and so on, and engaging all our functions in the context of doing those things that are pleasurable to him with intention of increasing his pleasure. There's no limit to how much pleasure Krishna can have, his rasaraj. And we as Shakti are destined to dedicate our lives to that noble project of perpetually increasing the pleasure experience of the Supreme. And of course, that in turn will make us fully joyful. Raso aisaha rasam hi vayam ladvanandi bhavati, says Taittiriya Upanishad. His rasika as well. Rasa rasika, rasa rasika kripa moyas, Thakur Bhaktivinoda will sing. So his rasa itself, but also he tastes rasa. So, and Taittiriya Upanishad said, he who rasam hi vayam ladvanandi bhavati, he who attains him who is rasa becomes anandi, becomes blissful. So that's us in prospect. So those are the three main qualities of uttam bhakti. Krishna anusilanam anukulyena an anyabilasita sunyam gyan parmadhyana britam. The tadastha lakshan, or marginal byproduct like characteristics, are bhakti is devoid of all other desire. Not of all desire, because it has to be full of desire, but it's one-pointed ekagrata desire in the direction that I mentioned, Krishna anusilanam anukulyena. But devoid of all other, anya means all other desire, apart from this desire to give pleasure to Hari. So devoid of that, and jnana karma adi anabritam, not unencumbered by jnana karma adi, and other types of things like jnana, like tapasya, yoga, and some other things. And we will a little bit explain more about what's the meaning of that. So I have to begin with that. What's uttam bhakti? Because we are supposed to practice that. So how we are to embrace this uttam bhakti school in such a way, and deal with the world in such a way that our conception and practice and fruit of uttam bhakti doesn't get downplayed, misread, diluted, and so on. So to begin with, I would like to, the question says, how should devotees aspiring to practice uttam bhakti, so we define that, react when they come across someone suffering materially? So of course, the person who made the question is not next to me here or nor connected, so I cannot ask immediately, what does he mean by suffering materially? Or sometimes what do we mean by that? Because we may express that, but sometimes we may not have a clear notion of the implications of the term when we play out the term. So it's important that whenever we ask a question, we ask ourselves the question, questions regarding that question. What do we mean by, in this case, suffering materially? Suffering materially means that we are suffering out of karma, in the realm of karma, because in that case we may say, okay, that this does not technically apply to a Vaishnava who has taken shelter in Krishna. Because if you surrender to Krishna, and again I'm giving a general idea, we are not analyzing specifics and individual cases here, but Krishna says, what? Sarva papi vimokshayisyami masata. Ham tvam sarva papi vimokshayisyami. So I will take all your papa, all your sinful reactions, So do not fear. I will free you from all that. So we cannot speak in terms of karma when we speak about the devotee. Mm-hmm. Vishwanath Chakravarti will use the term shobana karma, which means even if it seems that the devotee is still going through reaction, the chain of action and reaction, if he has surrendered unto Bhagavan, Bhagavan is taking personally responsibility for his devotee. So many sections in Shastra mentioning that. You know, famous one is when the Kumars are cursing Jai and Bijai at the gates of Vaikuntha, the pearly gates, and Narayan himself appears on his scene, taking full responsibility for whatever his servants have done. And with that making the point, I'm taking care of them. Rakshishyat Vishvasu Goptritu Ivaranam. I'm maintaining them, I'm protecting them. They are my all in all, basically, and I'm their all in all. Sadhavu Hridayam Mayam Sadhunam Hridayam Tuham. So it's important to have these things in clear. Again, if we are directing this idea of suffering materially to a devotee, strictly speaking, a devotee should not be suffering materially. So it may be suffering, but a devotee is suffering with purpose, if you will. And that suffering is being personally arranged by Bhagavan. Dasyam anugrinami, Krishna says in Harisya Taddhanam Shanai. To those who I want to show my special mercy, I gradually deprive them from all their wealth, which basically means from all those things, their false sense of wealth that they are attached to, basically. So externally, that may take the form of some catastrophic situation, tragic scenario, but it may be actually Krishna bestowing his mercy upon that devotee. And if someone is a surrendered devotee, that person will, of course, react accordingly to that. So when we say suffering materially, strictly speaking, we are referring to someone who is outside of the realm of bhakti, who is suffering out of karma, not shobana karma, but karma, period. Action, reaction, maya shakti, tatastha shakti, interacting with maya shakti without the intervention of bhakti shakti. And on top of that, we may say someone who is not learning from it. Because also there are so many degrees. You may have someone suffering, materially speaking, and somehow learning from that, but on some level not learning from that at all. And you are really suffering materially. Because sometimes you can suffer materially, but that situation takes you to the need for the spiritual. So how much you can call that material suffering. So again, in the case of a devotee, that shouldn't be happening. Even if some suffering comes, some reaction comes, that is again especially arranged by Bhagavan, the devotee will take advantage of that situation to increase his, her drenching into Hari Kirtan, into prayer, into shelter. Tattenu kampam susamikshamano bunjane batmakritam vipakam haritbhagbapurbir vidadam namaste jivita jumuktipade sadayavak. Sri Brahma says in Brahma Stuti. Krishna is saying, Brahma is saying to Krishna, to whomever you want to show very special grace, that person will happen the following. That person will be receiving the results of their previous misdeeds, if a devotee, but again, in the context of your grace. So some karma was there before bhakti enters one's life, one took shelter in bhakti, and those reactions now take another form. Or one is equipped with a particular orientation that will make one deal with those reactions in a different form. So what's that form? Of course, hit bhadba putbir vidadam namaste. Brahma is saying, your devotee, whenever he has to go through whatever remaining reactions of previous misdeeds, again, in the context of shobana karma, he or she will engage deeper even, in hearing about you, serving you with their heart, mind, words, body, and therefore becoming duly heir to your throne, if you will, to the throne of bhakti, basically. So some words regarding the notion of suffering materially, because again, we may use the term loosely without understanding the implications. Of course, I assume that the main part of the question is connected to suffering materially, to in this case, the people of Ukraine, and not necessarily the Vaishnavs or the Vaishnavs in Ukraine. So there are some differences in that sense. There are differences in suffering, as we mentioned. We say suffering materially, but again, it's important to become accurate in the words we use, in the thoughts we attach to the words we use, and of course everything else that falls from that. So we spoke the other day, in a very brief depiction, we can say three types of suffering. You have three types of lamentation of suffering. You have the lamentation of the suffering of a bhada jiv. So a devotee is seeing a conditioned soul suffering out of course, being slain, if you will, by the loss of karma, by the particular reaction that corresponds with some previous action. So the devotee will try to show compassion unto that person by delivering a particular message, a particular knowledge that will free them for further future reactions in that same line. Because if you are not enlightened, generally you tend to repeat history and do again the same thing with the renewed hope, quote-unquote, of this time will work and so on. In the case of a sadaka, there is suffering and lamentation, but mostly in the case, depending on the stage of proper repentance, you know, like Mahaprabhu show in the second verse of Sikshastakam, Durdhaiva Midrishami Hajjanina Anurag. All this grace is coming to me in the form of Srinam and so on, but I'm so unfortunate that I don't have taste for Srinam because of anarthas. My durdaivan, my lack of fortune is due to the presence of a false reading, false sense of value, anartha. So I feel some repentance that purifies me and furthers my commitment with bhakti. And then we have another type of suffering as our lamentation in the figure of the sita, that may be lamenting out of separation, divine love, deep longing, in bhava longing for its deity, his her deity, sorry. Like Madhavendra Puri praying at the end of his life, Adidi Nadaradhanatrahe Maturanat Kalavalyokyashi Hridayam Tamaloka Katanandhaita Brahmyati Kinkaromya. So many of these prayers, Mahaprabhu himself in the Gambiras, Raghunath Das Goswami, his beloved Kusumanjali, Rupa Goswami, Utkalika Valari, all these works that show these personalities at the very end of their lives, getting closer and closer to the entering, if you will, into the Nitya Lila. So expressing in a particular way, expressing a type of suffering. So again, we have suffering of a bhada jiv, suffering of a sadaka, suffering of a sita. And so there are different ways to deal with that, to alleviate that, if you will. And again, going back to the situation, I gave some perspective there, but going back to the situation which mostly the question deals with is, okay, we have bhada jivas who are suffering materially, as we mentioned, out of a particular karma. So alleviating suffering in others, of course, there are so many things we can do, as I mentioned in the in my brief words some days ago on the war. Be the change you want to see in the world. Like, for if you are there, you can offer some practical solutions. You can offer shelter, food, and help people. As we will see, that's not against bhakti. That's not a bad thing to be sensitive and compassionate. But also an important thing in general, and hopefully I don't sound too much abstract with this, is that suffering is perceived in the mind, as you may know. Whatever you may feel suffering in a particular given situation, while another person in that very same situation is not feeling suffering. So the suffering is not in the situation itself that people is going through, but in how you are dealing with that in your mind. Famous example of Viktor Frankl and his Man in Search of Meaning, when he was in the Holocaust in Auschwitz, being prisoner there and going through the whole thing, surviving and finding deep purpose and meaning in the whole thing I'm not saying he was not suffering, but as we mentioned, he knew how to suffer. He was drawing something from suffering. As we always say, goal of life is not so much stop suffering, but learn to suffer. Learn from suffering. And when you learn from suffering, it's not suffering anymore, technically speaking. You are drawing so much insight, so much maturity, so much enlightenment is coming. So how much you can still call that suffering? So again, suffering in others has the suffering, alleviating suffering in others has to do with the mental perception. So for example, if we are to apply the question to, okay, we are here on the other side of the world, on America or whatever, so you may like to pray in the distance for the Ukrainian devotees, which of course there's nothing wrong about that. So devotees, you know, okay, sir, some devotees are in this terrible condition during war and so on. So one way of thinking is, okay, if he is a devotee, she is a devotee, I will pray so they have the proper vision, the mental strength to go through all this in full Krishna consciousness, basically. Again, if we are in the distance, then we cannot offer any further practical help. That also is quite required. But that's one of the ways you can direct the prayer with conception, uttam bhakti conception. May they become more attached to Krishna in these particular difficulties. Again, we have so many examples in Shastra of terrible situations. I mean, just not to go too far, Bhagavad Gita is depicted in just before, in one sense, a much bigger war than the one we are witnessing in the world now. If you know all the people involved, all the people that eventually were killed in Kurukshetra and so on. And Arjuna is just about to do that in a very terrible situation, as we know, trying to face friends and guru and so on. So, and Bhagavad Gita came from the midst of that, again, from the most unlikely, unthinkable, difficult scenario, the greatest wisdom can emerge. So that's a very paradoxical constant of life. So again, devotees, we have to think, okay, if they are devotees, they have, of course, there are degrees of devotees, and we are maybe too general here, but you pray that a devotee may increase their devotiness, their devotion, basically, in a condition like this. Of course, you don't want anyone to be killed. You are not promoting people dying and so on. But ultimately, the real blessing and the real prayer has to do with may they Krishna materials too, as Prahlad Maharaj will say. May your intelligence be with Krishna. May you increase your Krishna consciousness. May all this situation take you closer to Krishna. Whatever it happens externally. Because, I mean, you may be dying, basically. Maybe you are leaving your body, like a famous example of Parikshit Maharaj, in imminent death, 7 days. And you cannot do anything about that. I mean, he could, but he preferred to embrace, if you will, destiny and Krishna's will. But my point is, if you know that may happen or that will happen, I mean, you can deal with that in a way that you get closer to Krishna. You are getting to Krishna directly. And that's the blessing. It's not that, oh, he died, so there was not as much blessing as if he would have remained alive. No, he embraced death, the perspective of death, in such a way that he got closer to Bhagavan. So that's the blessing. And on the other side, someone may remain alive without increasing their God consciousness, and maybe the opposite, which can happen as well. Can happen. So again, it's important to see beyond the particular framework of this lifetime when thinking about what's the ultimate blessing, what's the ultimate prayer. And of course, when I'm saying this, we have to bear in mind there are different degrees of people, there are different degrees of devotees, which also means there are different degrees of people of devotees. And conceptions and readings of Shastra and addresses of the practices. I sometimes like to say, Ekanishtha Adhikari is someone who reads Shastra through the lens of their emotions. And a Madhyam Adhikari is someone who reads their emotions through the lens of Shastra. So that's a very clear difference between the two. And of course, if someone asks, what about the Uttama Adhikari, the Uttama Bhagavat? Actually, not so much Adhikari, but Bhagavat. Well, their emotions are Shastra in itself. Whatever emotions they have, that's Shastra. Basically, that's what Shastra is pointing to as the ultimate goal. So, and ideally we should try to have Shastra in mind when we are trying to engage in Bhakti, when we are trying to develop our Shraddha. Our faith has to be Shastra, Shraddha. And again, the very definition of Shraddha, what's the very definition of Shraddha that, for example, Krishna Das Kaviraj Goswami is given? Shraddha sabde kahe vishwas dhrida nishchay Krishna bhakti kaile sarva karma kritta hai. So Shraddha sabde vishwas dhrida nishchay. Shraddha means to have a very deep confidence that by engaging in Krishna bhakti, I don't need to engage in any other thing. By praying for further Krishna bhakti in me or in others, I do not need to pray for any other thing. That's which is synonym with the notion of Saranagati, and that's why Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakur mentions Saranagati is the outer expression of Shraddha. And that's a very great point and contribution that Thakur has given us. Because if you analyze what's the very definition of Shraddha, means you engage in bhakti, and you know that I don't need to do anything else apart from bhakti, apart from uttam bhakti for us. I have that confidence, I have that sudhrida nishchaya, that firm conviction, determination, that this is the actual pouring water on the root of the tree. I don't need to entertain any other relative options. And what's Saranagati? Sarva dharma parityaja mam ekam sharanam braj. Krishna is saying, leave everything behind, leave all conceptions, even all religious conceptions behind, and just give yourself to me fully, which is Saranagati, full surrender, and which happens to be synonymous with the very definition of Shraddha. So this is a very, simple, if you will, point, not so simple, but that we may hear often, but that's the foundation of the whole bhakti project. The whole Mahamandir, the whole temple we will to build in our heart, it has to have proper foundation. The foundation is invisible. Nobody sees the foundation in a building, but that's sustaining the whole thing. So Saranagati, it's very important to have that in place, even though we may not... you can make a show of that externally, but that's a very internal thing, a very invisible thing, if you will, in that sense, a very intimate thing. So we have to have proper idea of this. And of course, yes, if we speak about Uttam Bhakti, as I mentioned, Krishna is the object of Uttam Bhakti. And of course, Sri Krishna, we could say, the word Sri is in the verse also, or is sometimes extended, and Sri can include the devotees. So they are the objects of our bhakti, of our uttam bhakti, of our affection, of our prayers. Interestingly, if you go to Golok, Yashoda is praying for Krishna. They are worshipping Narayan, but they are praying for Krishna, for Krishna's welfare, for Krishna's protection. We may be praying for Krishna's protection on us, but in the Leela they are praying for Krishna's protect from Narayana's protection on Krishna, if you will. Things like this. So the object of Uttam Bhakti, yes, is Krishna. The object of Uttam Bhakti is not any other living entity that we are directing our Uttam Bhakti to. But at the same time, of course, if we have proper understanding, we will understand, of course. Part of Uttam Bhakti has to do with, for example, jivadai, nam ruchi jivadai, sarva dharma sar. To develop ruchi for Srinam and to be merciful to all jivas, that's the essence of dharma. And the dharma for a Vaishnava. So jivadai is an important point for us. That's one of the teachings of Mahaprabhu. We remember when Sri Rupa Goswami chastised Sri Jiva Goswami for a particular situation, and eventually Sanatana Goswami goes there, senior to Sri Rupa, and asks Sri Rupa, which are the teachings of Mahaprabhu, of our Prabhu. Sri Jiva was living in the hole on the ground, basically, in separation, crying for being distant and chastised by his Gurudev. And Rupa Goswami starts to enumerate all these teachings. And Sanatana Goswami, okay. And he was waiting for one. And when Rupa Goswami says, Jiva Dai, Sanatana Goswami points at that, Jiva Dai. Which means, of course, be merciful to all Jivas, but also can mean be merciful to Jiva, to Sri Jiva Goswami. And that's when Sri Rupa calls Sri Jiva Goswami back. But again, one of the teachings of Mahaprabhu is Jiva Dai, to be merciful to all Jivas. That's not a problem, that's not a sin, or that's not whatever, an offense. I mean, but Thakur Bhakti not mentioned that there are four types of anarthas, and he subdivided them in four. And one of the categories is aparad. And in that category, there are four types of aparad, and one type of aparad is jiva aparad. So we are not to offend other people, even if they are not bhaktas. I mean, potentially they are bhaktas. And again, this has again to do with one's conception, one's level of adhikar, because as it is said, for example, in Uttam Bhagavat, Sarbhabhutesu yatpasyet Bhagavat Bhagavati Atmani, and so on, he will see everyone, Krishna in everyone, and everyone in Krishna. He won't see non-devotees. So that's his, her subjective perception of reality, which is much cherished and venerated by us. So how can you say how this will take place in that particular case? He will see devotees everywhere, basically. He will see Krishna's presence everywhere. And we, even though we are not on that level, and we shouldn't imitate that, we should take the gist of that and at least be generous enough to see the potential for bhakti in every single jiva. So in that sense, our perception of the world, our perception of other people is not so much in terms of how they are karmis, or they are whatever designation, whatever upadhi you may like to label them with. But they are potential, they have potential for bhakti, they are potential bhaktas. So somehow, that particular perspective already is attracting Bhakti Devi's presence into the life of that particular soul. So that's a very interesting idea. But of course, again, going back to the point, hopefully I'm sharing something that makes sense, because there are many ideas that I may be sharing interwoven, because the question back for that, if you will. One of part of the question is, well, some devotees have been offering the fruits of their practices for the people in Ukraine or this or that, but mostly maybe they have been speaking in terms of offering one on the merits of one's sadhana, offering the whatever auspiciousness and merits of one's. So again, it's all about the conception. How the devotees who are doing that offering, what do they understand by merit? What do they understand by the offering they are performing? I cannot say, because I don't know who those devotees are. But, and again, it's there is a lot of semantic trickery here, in the sense that you can use the word merit and mean so many things. And so the important thing is to know, what do you mean by that? Because merit or punya, yeah, it can refer to material piety, but also punya refers to bhakti sukriti. Krita punya punja. That's a very famous expression found in Shastra many times, in which the one speaking the verse is wondering what auspicious activities that person performed to have the fortune of whatever fortune is there. And that's generally the context of devotion. Pranamami tat paramat madhuri britta kitra punya punya garasidu mani upasana jovana gurora dhirtya jasmar keli kushalam dhan haru. That's a famous verse in the context of the gopis, speaking about their good fortune. So punya can mean, again, bhakti sukriti. Punya can mean ordinary piety. So if we take punya as ordinary mundane piety or whatever type of auspiciousness that do not involve bhakti sukriti, that's not technically part of uttam bhakti. Because there are no punya involved in uttam bhakti. One famous definition of prem bhakti in the raga mark as invoked by Raya Ramananda to Mahaprabhu in their sambhad or conversation is Krishna bhakti rasa bhavitamati kriyatam yadi kutu pilavyate tatra laulam api kalam mulam janma koti sukritaya nalavyate. So there it is described, originally verse from Sri Rupa Goswami, that Krishna bhakti rasa, to have one's mind intelligence saturated with Krishna bhakti rasa, it's not something easy to attain, basically. You have to have firm, intense longing for that, greed for that. And janma koti sukritar malabhiti. No matter how many, you can have millions, koti, of sukriti, birth, janma. So you can be born as in a very pious situation. You can amass, accumulate tons, lakhs, crores of piety, nalabhyate. You are not able to attain that because the qualification to attain that is not in terms of sattva gun or whatever, virtue in this plane, but lolyam. Tatra lolyam ikalam, ikalam molyam, lolyam ikalam, only lolyam, only lobha, only greed. So in uttam bhakti, which for us of course has to do with raga bhakti, because uttam bhakti has these two divisions as Srila Rupa Goswami describes. He first describes uttam bhakti, then he describes of course sadhana bhakti, and in sadhana bhakti he speaks about bhaidi bhakti and raga bhakti. So we are for the raga bhakti, if you will, project. So there are no merits involved in uttam bhakti. Indeed, that's an obstacle. If you think that you need to engage in some particular forms of piety or some specific ritual that will invoke piety to foster your bhakti, that you need to do something other than engage in something other than uttam bhakti, that's not in line with the very definition of the shraddha you should be having in bhakti. And of course, as Krishna says in the Gita, there are shades of rajas, tamas, sattva in connection to one's shraddha. That can happen. Of course, it shouldn't. In the Bhagavatam, Krishna is saying to that, whoever has shraddha in me properly, that's nirgun. That's beyond the modes. So, karma adi anabritam, gyan karma adi anabritam. The very definition of uttam bhakti says that. You should be engaging in uttam bhakti, in the limbs, main limbs of uttam bhakti, with the faith, this is all. I don't need to engage in anything else. But maybe, Sri Jiva Goswami comments there, you may be engaging, and this is another possibility that can be connected with the present question. Some people, maybe, for example, he says, engage in the Shraddha ceremony, as Mahaprabhu himself did when his father passed away. And in the Shraddha ceremony, he are offering oblations, pinda, to the ancestors and so on. That's mostly connected with karma kanda and these sections of shastra, not with uttam bhakti. But you can be engaged in all those things out of lokavichar. Lokavichar means public opinion. That's a social thing that if you are not doing that, that may create some obstacles from the environment, and that may be not so becoming for your engagement in bhakti. So you may be engaging all those things, but not with the shraddha, with the faith that I need to do the things. Actually, I have the faith by doing bhakti, everything is accomplished. But I'll do that out of lokavichar, public consideration. So there's a place for that. That's not necessarily cheating, if you will, being hypocrite. So again, it's all about conception. A devotee can pray for others, indeed he, she should, and that's not a problem. When Mahaprabhu, before Mahaprabhu was Mahaprabhu, if you will, when he was Nimaya Pandit and he had not unfolded his Leela as a Vaishnava, it is said that the devotees in Navadvip, they were so willing for him to become a Vaishnava that at one point they started to pray for him. May he become a Vaishnava. May he become a Vaishnava. And eventually the teaching, of course, is, okay, Nimai became a Vaishnava because of the prayers of the Vaishnavas. That's way, one way to put it, in the unfolding of the Leela. And so they were praying for someone else who was not a devotee, overtly. Nimai, he was a Pandit, but not a Vaishnava in the Leela. So he became a Vaishnava because of those prayers. Or Advaita Charya also, when having a glimpse at the condition of the world before inviting Mahaprabhu to descend, being frustrated by the lack of Krishna Bhakti, but his frustration took him to a deep sense of compassion, and he started to pray, as we know, while offering Ganga Jal, Tulsi, for the Yuga Avatar to descend. So his frustration took him to compassion, and his compassion took him to a prayer regarding the condition of the world at the time. So he was praying out of that. Of course, the next question is, we are praying out of what? Even if we are praying for the people in Ukraine, out of what we are praying? And I cannot reply that for you. You have to be honest with yourself. Because very quickly we say, out of compassion. But it's important to go deeper. Or at least go deeper, and I'm not saying that compassion is not deep enough, but to go deeper to see if there's not other hidden things in between. Because sometimes we may be doing all the things from a comfort zone, from a place that, okay, these people are suffering, I pray for them, and as a way of feeling good with myself. Like, I'm doing this, I'm praying for them, I'm a good person. But actually, maybe that's not enough. Maybe again, we are using prayer in our own service to remain in the comfort zone and to do not need the necessary change we need to go through in our particular case, to embrace the wars we need to go through. So sometimes that happens a lot. Or sometimes people go in the street and give some charity. And actually that may not be out of compassion, but a way of, again, fostering a false sense of I'm good or I'm even better than you. Or things like this. Like you see someone suffering and you say, oh well, I'm not suffering that much. So you remain in a particular situation there and so on. So there is place for praying for others out of, hopefully, proper compassion. And proper compassion has to do with the inner condition of the person. But of course, sometimes for someone to become more absorbed in Krishna first, those people need to get solved some other situations. You follow? I mean, if someone is dying of thirst in the desert, I may understand, yes, real compassion is to make that person close to Krishna. And if I am to share the message with them, or with him or with her, probably first I have to get a glass of water for that person. No, so the most immediate urgency, his dying of thirst, is solved. Some gratitude, there is some exchange that we can progress into another stages. But it's important to keep that in mind. Even when given the glass of water, we are being human, we are being compassionate, but we are not cheating ourselves thinking that's enough. That's the only thing I can do or the only thing the person needs. Because, I mean, in perspective, what's a glass of water in eternity? That's not the great thing for us. That's a great thing for that particular moment, but but the real need of the Atma goes way beyond that. But again, there is place to develop compassion, to engage in sometimes what's called intercessionary prayer, that you are praying not necessarily for you or for increasing your own status in bhakti, but you are praying in connection to some other person. But again, within the framework of Uttam Bhakti, the ideal thing is whatever we are doing is not transgressing the perimeter of Uttam Bhakti. And Uttam Bhakti is so user-friendly, it's so wide and so deep that it's offering us the chance. But of course, that doesn't mean that we can do anything and everything, and that's still Uttam Bhakti. Because we are not Uttam Bhaktas in the ultimate sense of the term. So we may need to have some sense of our limits as well. And again, that has a lot to do with introspection and not imitation. But it's important to, for example, if you feel helpless in the face of others' suffering, which I imagine a lot of people is going through that nowadays, all those things helps us feeling human. And again, the goal of life is not feeling human, but the goal of life includes being human, not a lila. So as I always like to say, our goal in transcendence is not a dismissal of humanity. It's not being indifferent towards our human condition, but putting humanity into the perspective of divinity, connecting one with the other. So what all those things that foster our humanity can have the potential to foster our uttam bhakti if we understand how humanity is there in the service of bhakti. If you understand our humanity, our development as humans, again, it's not the ultimate goal, but it's an important part of us attaining our ultimate goal. You cannot attain Nara Lila if you are not developing your human sensibilities. So again, feeling helpless in the face of other suffering helps us feeling human, to feel human. And that in turn helps us to properly approach and conceive Nara Lila. Again, that's not the all in all. It's not that just facing a situation like this will take us to Golok Vrindavan. But we can face a situation like this in such a way that is taking us closer to Golok Vrindavan. That's not our whole sadhana. I'm just seeing the news and the war, developing my compassion for the people in Ukraine, and that's my method to attain transcendence. Well, you may need to do some other things, but that thing can also be important. That can be some form of Sangha Siddha Bhakti, if you will. An activity that is not in itself bhakti, but that can be approached in such a way that may become bhakti because it's fostering our embrace of the principle. So, yeah, to be empathic is not against bhakti. In this case, it will be mostly maybe cognitive empathy. We have spoken about cognitive and affective empathy. So cognitive empathy means you have never gone through what the other person is going, but you can understand on some level what's going on and you feel empathy. Affective empathy is you have had that same experience yourself, so you can have an empathy from another perspective. But from one or the other options, the idea is be empathic no matter what. Whether you have gone through the situation yourself or you have not gone, make an effort to understand what must be that for the other person. And by that exercise, of course, again, you increase your humanity, you increase your sensibility, you increase your sympathy, your so many things, your compassion. And again, we are not cheating ourselves thinking that's the all in all, but that's something necessary. Again, for us, as sadhakas, for other people, to receive some blessing and connection by the Vaishnav, and that's counting on the Vrinda bank, if you will, on the bank bhakti account. If a very powerful Vaishnav is praying, even in a more generic sense, not for a specific person, but for a particular situation, and again, with proper conceptual orientation, proper sambandha, and so on, of course, that will create some effect. It's not just numbness. Not like Prahlad Maharaj saying, if you become a pure devotee, many generations of your ancestors will be blessed, even though they didn't have a clue about that. That speaks about the power of bhakti and the power of a bhakta. And of course, again, that has to be properly expressed. It's not that someone will say, Maharaj, but the Gita says that the soul cannot be burned, the soul cannot be killed. So actually nobody is being killed in the war. So we shouldn't lament. I mean, there's Krishna say that to Arjuna in the Gita. So many verses in the second chapter about that. Yes, but we have to know, we need to assure those ideas with humanity. We have to be very careful that we are incorporating these notions in a way that is according to our particular level of realization. Because again, if not, it can be anukar and not anusar. Anukar means imitation. Anusar means following the essence of that. So again, in conclusion, and today I think this was the main topic of today's lecture, since also I have not received any other questions, and somehow the topic deserves some unfolding, and I'm not saying that this is the all in all, so many things can be said, but I will say that a situation like this, or a situation like a devotee praying for others in a difficult situation, even material situation, someone who is not a devotee on the other side, all that can be done without compromising one's uttam bhakti. But again, if we do that with the proper conception, whether the person on the other side, again, is a devotee, karmi, yogi, jnani, which again, there are different people with different stances and different conceptions, but we have to take full responsibility, if you will, and we have to concentrate on what do we understand, again, by uttam bhakti, by material suffering, by merit, by being compassionate, and so many other things, that when all the things are in place, naturally our avideya, our action will be performed accordingly, and we'll bear the proper fruit. So, some words I want to share today in this connection. I hope that helps in complement to the other brief words we shared some days ago on being the change we want to see in the world, which again, at the end of the day, beyond all that we can do practically, if we are here or there, if beyond all we can do in terms of prayer, at the end of the day, we have to take responsibility for ourselves and deal with the inner words we still have not solved. And that's part of solving the war problem, not only in the world, but beyond that even. So thank you so much for your time, attention, questions, and see you next Friday. Srila Gurudev ki jai. Shriman Mahaprabhu ki jai. Sri Harinam Sankirtan ki jai. Sri Sri Kanuram ki jai. Gaur Bhakta Vrinda ki jai. Gaur Pramananda Devo.